talked to Kyle. I just drew back and I was, how you doing? Terrible. What's the matter? Because I can't get anybody to talk. I thought, oh, that's a lot of people. No, I said, I went to the mayor, Woodford, and we talked. And I said, let me turn on my machine. Oh, I'm busy. And refused, and he was rather upset. Come to do a job, and nobody talked. I said, well, you still can't find anybody. I said, come on over to the house. I said, well, I'll talk. I'll call you and report it. So he did, he came over and had coffee and recorded for 5 hours. But I even took him for a drive. He hadn't ever seen the canyon. And I said, well, you're recording. I said, come on, I'll drive you up there. He'll show it to me. So we did. The tail end, I was forced from talking. I said, well, I want to make one more statement. And if this recording is used, if anybody hears it, and if they pay any attention at all, I want them to really hear this one. If ever I or any member of my family are ever in another disaster, if flood, fire, wind, earthquake, whatever, we've all agreed we're going to grab what we can grab and run. And just run and keep running and get away. Because going through the aftermath, after the earthquake, you take our town over there, 1,200 people. None of us had ever been helped. Terrible, difficult thing to be helped for the first time in your life. You don't know how to receive it, and you get angry. Oh, okay. It was just terrible. Then I learned enough, though, that the agencies weren't out to put you down. They had to be careful. There was a guy came to Valdez, and boy, he was in, I was in high school. That's where everybody had a room, Red Cross and one, SBA and everything. And the fellow said, the Red Cross fellow says, see that fellow coming in here? And, you know, who is he? Darn fellow. But I said, don't worry about that. I'm comparatively new here, and I don't know everybody. Ask the chief of police, he's right out there in the hall. That guy was a phony. He was going from town to town, getting everything he could get. He wasn't even here. He came up on a plane after the earthquake, claiming that his family was disappeared and he had to get there. And so there was reasons for Red Cross and Salvation Army and everything to kind of put you down. So, but that was a very difficult thing, to receive help. You never know until it happens. And one of you needed help. There's no doubt about it.
Did people receive it though, Ed?
Yes, but they had to kind of force it on us. I finally agreed to take four tires from Red Cross if they would let me pay it back. I wanted to pay it back. I didn't want anybody to give me four tires that I'd ruin going through the crevasses. But she absolutely, that lady just wouldn't want me to even consider it. Like, well, I'll fix you, I'll donate it. But I did, mm-hmm. But I didn't, not to them, like, it was the Salvation Army. But anyhow, I have not been thinking of what I'm going to talk about tonight for a long time. It was the war. And I like to think about nice things rather than bad things. Like, war is bad. Especially right now, I'm noticing that we are being subject to many war movies, old and new. It's happened to me once before in my life. I was 18 years old. Well, actually, it started when I was 17. There's been a lot of movies, war. And I got to be concerned and thought there was going to be a war. And I thought, gee, I wonder where the best place to be in a war. Like, someplace where you didn't get shot. Well, I worried about it. I joined the media, and they wouldn't have me. And so So I found out I had a problem, so I corrected it later, and then I joined the Army, 1936. My friend said, what are you doing? That time, the Army was a very, very low organization. And I didn't know how low it was until I got into the board. But anyhow, I said, well, look, fellas, there's going to be a blast of war. And I'm going to learn about this. And this is what planning will get you. I got in a place that I got shot at everywhere I went. And I went to the Aleutians. I went 9 trips to the Aleutians. So that's really planning. I was getting myself in a position where I wouldn't get shot. But what happened? I wound up in Alaska in 1942, early part of 42. General Buckner, who was the head of the Alaskan command, said to a very prominent colonel, Colonel Kastner. He said, you know, I don't know what's going on. This place is too big. I don't have anybody to ask questions. The colonel said, I'll show you how to fix that. Let's organize a small group, special people, many classes of life, like fishermen, miners, flyers, everything, trappers. And then we'll just spread them out. In Alaska, all we have to do is ask them what's going on. So they did. They started selecting. I heard about it, and in fact, some of my friends were in it. I wanted to get in it. Our colonel at that time decided he was going to keep all of his old timers. He was in the Army 6 months, he was an old timer by that time, so he wouldn't let us out. He would let me out. And then he had to go to Washington or something. While he was gone, Sergeant Majors was in the guy that took his place and signed anything, I put it in front of him. And I said, well, get it in front of him. I got out and got into this little group called many things. We were officially Combat Intelligence Platoon, Alaska Department, in G2. Then we were later called the Scouts. Then we were, got a name that became quite famous in the magazines of the day, about Evening Post, Time, Collier's. We were called Kastner's Cutthroats. And the story behind that was that we wore about what we wanted to. I found that some Navy clothes suited me and some Army and some civilian clothes. So we all outfitted ourselves for ourselves. We didn't have a, we didn't wear a necktie, of course. And some of them with beards, and pretty rough looking outfit at the time. We're down in the Aleutians and missed one trip. Colonel Kastner was, we were individuals. Everybody carried his own pack, everyone cooked his own food, caught it or acquired it, one way or the other. And the colonel was down in the stream mucking out his fry pan, and a soldier came by. This was after the invasion. We had a lot of soldiers there at that time. Soldier came by and said, hey, buddy, what outfit is this? And the colonel says, this is Kastner's outfit. Kastner Scouts. Guys, this looks like a bunch of damn cutthroats to me. And that stuck. From then on, Colonel, he was excited about it and told it around, and pretty soon we were known as the Kastner's Cutthroats. The Japanese endeavored, they tried to fool the Pacific Command. They wanted to go into the South Pacific with force. See, we were, once we got a hole, we started backing them up. And they wanted to wipe out Pacific Force. So they made a big splash. They sent some ships to Alaska. And they came in with a small aircraft carrier and came in and bombed and strafed the small installation, U.S. installation at Dutch Harbor. And while they were doing that, they brought in barges and ships and landed troops at Attum and Kiska in pretty good force. 3,600 at Attum and 10,000 at Kiska. Then they sprinkled a few more around through the, had radios, gathered information. So when they strapped the Dutch Harbor, we were in Anchorage, and we decided, by God, we're going to go up and fill them guys up. We had 36 men of an entire force. So we spent the night filling machine gun belts with ammunition and went down and got on a little boat down in the harbor called the Cavanaugh, this little yacht. A general made this available to this general for his boat, and we borrowed. And we got clear to Dutch Harbor, clear to Pontiac, before the Navy caught us. They said, cut that out, fellas, you can't do that. Sure, why not? We're tough. We'll go down there and just run our tanks up. But the Navy said, we're running this war, so back off. Don't do it. Then we started working with the Navy, and they made two submarines available to us. First, a little bit about our training. We had to learn to drive every vehicle made. We had to learn to shoot everything that they had to shoot. We learned demolitions, map making, the works. Plus, we had to be somewhat oriented to live in the country. And we had some fabulous men. Hunters, trappers, oh, they were just a super group. The reason I was selected, they needed someone that knew a little bit about the Army. Like, what do you do when you meet a colonel? We had guys, a guy named Joe Mello, he's a trapper. He was down at Dutch. The colonel came in with a couple of generals on the plane. Joe went out. Oh, hi, Colonel. Shook hands. this private shaking hands and stood right there. You want to get introduced to the generals, too. So he asked me how to treat us. He just put his arm around Joe and acted like his good old buddy. The invasion forces came. Now, first, the submarine deals. We wanted to go in quietly and find out, and go from island to island and find out where they all were. We, at that time, really didn't know. So we stopped at Dutch and built two boats. We built the keel and the ribs. Did each one of them, well, there was two crews. There was 22 people in each crew. And we built them in 24 hours. Lashed them on the submarine. After the conning tower, without any canvas on it. We just had the ribs and then we had the canvas down in the sub. The scheme was we're going to cruise out, which we did. And there was a turbulence behind the conning tower that tore our boat right off, so we didn't have that. But they had rubber boats for us to go ashore with. And we pulled into ADAC first, and we knew that there were a few Japanese there. And the scheme was, it was always black. Ooh, it was just blacker than anything. And I was on a sub that was a very famous sub. It was the one that supposedly sneaked into the harbor in Tokyo and torpedoed an aircraft carrier as it came off the waves. It didn't quite do that, but that was a pretty darn good story. And we needed some good stories that phase of the war. And later I couldn't remember the name of that sub, which I should have, because it saved my life. So I'll tell you that part of it. The scheme was, two of us were to, well, they inflated the boats. It was so black that you just had to go, somebody would take you along by the hand. You just couldn't see a thing. We were 2.5 miles offshore, blacker than blazes. The scheme was, another fellow named Wilbur Church, were to shove off first and secure the beach. The DAR, our regular paraphernalia. So the Navy, the sailors were inflating these boats. And we got on our little two-man boat, and I kept hearing a hissing noise. And I was thinking, it was going to blow up or got a hole in it or something. So I called the sailor and said, hey, man, what's this? Hear that noise? Oh, he said, I don't know, he said, I'll go find out. Well, about that time, somebody says, number one, shove off. And we shoved off, and offshore wind was blowing, good waves. And we got about 300 yards of sun, and that blasted the boat and blew up. And of course, we're rising to drink. And the only thing that didn't blow up was a little petition in the center of the thing, to divide the two compartments up. And we had our packs, for all waterproof bags that we made ourselves with our food in. So we were buoyant, and we were afloat. And all of the other boats had shoved off. And they'd heard this explosion. We were just paddling around. And the submarine left. And for some reason, it chose to go this way. And we were over here. And just as they were going by, a hole came in the cloud. And there was a moon. It was very cloudy, but there was a hole, and they saw us in the drink. Fell out in the conning tower and the skipper. They were getting ready to go on out and submerge. And see, there's a couple of guys there. The captain said, we're not stopping. He was real scared. You know, he wasn't the skipper that took it into Tokyo. He had been called to Washington, and this was a new skipper on this sub. He was very excited about going too close to the shore. No, he said, we can't stop. And the guy reached down and got a line, and he threw it. Hung out and went in, and it hit me on the shoulder. And I had about this much past me. That's how close it was. And then the forward motion of the sub whipped us right over to the fantail. And I got a real education in how they build submarines. The huge pipes, a series of them to protect big objects. Boy, we didn't care. We hung that on, cruising right along. And I managed to get up on top. And we didn't turn loose of our boat. We still had our... had a line on it, and we brought that along with us, and we had all our gear. And Wilbur couldn't get up. He got this big pipe on his chest, and he's like that, and the water was hitting him on the back, and he couldn't get up. And I said, Wilbur, I said, now you, next time, and then we would go under. We'd just hold our breath until the back end would come up again. And I said, now the next time we come up, you let loose, and I'll grab you. Oh, no, he said, I'll never turn loose of this. I'll let you go on to Frisco. I'll ride right here. they came out then, and we got down, and boy, they really, that water was cold, and you're not supposed to be in it that long. And they stripped us, just as soon as we got down the deck, they just took our clothes right off, and those guys on all sides massaging us with towels, and the cook came with a bowl of soup, and a little sailor came up to me, and hey, Mac, he says, could you use a snort? I said, you bet. Me too. He and I had a drink. And so anyhow, so the next day was my birthday. I remember that very clearly. And years later, I could not remember the name of that song. Concerned me that. Geez, it's a dumb thing to forget the name of your rescuing boat. And my wife and I were in Connecticut, so we went to Rockford, the submarine headquarters. And a lady whose husband was a submariner was called by Francis' aunt, and she came and picked me up and took me to the library. And I told my story. I knew the date, absolutely, but I didn't know what ship or what sub. And I told the story a couple of times, and by golly, they started looking and came up with the logbook. And I have a copy of that page. I made a copy of one and picked this up. So we, that was one of our landings, and I had another misfortune. One of our landings was, we landed with everything. PBYs, landing barges, a destroyer that hit a reef. And by golly, they didn't lose any soldiers. We all made it to shore. But I experienced something there that I'll never forget. Comes up every once in a while. We had a fall. We had a lot of accomplished people in that group. And There's one fellow who could quote every single line in the Bible. And he was a professed atheist. And it was Hakers, Shaky Hakers. I said, well, Shaky, I said, how do you know this? Every word. Because he would discuss religion with real religious fellows. And he would always win. Well, he said, I got been trapping down in McGrath. And he did some illegal trapping. He got in jail. And he was in jail all winter in Fairbanks, and that was the only book in the whole jail. And he had a photogenic mind besides. And he read it and he could quote it. And during the after the hitting the reef and the ship broke apart, we all started swimming. And I made it to a rock. There was an awful, awful lot of seaweed. Just great acres of the kind of stuff. And I managed to get through it, and I got on a rock. I wasn't very sure yet, but I was on a rock. Mighty happy to be there. And I heard shaking. And I looked. I had got a headache, was just really tangled up in the seaweed. A wave would come in and disappear and come up in peace and mouth water and cursing. Who's the cursor? That's never heard. So he finally, the last word that he said was, all right, you old red-whiskered carpenter, you've got me. And he went down. And that, I just, it just gave me some strength, and I started pulling seaweed. And by golly, I got it to my rock. And I don't know what to do with it, so I just laid him on his stomach and pounded him, head down, and water run out, and come back. And, but that fellow had claimed to be an atheist, and he did in his dying breath. He was true to his word. And he's still around in Alaska somewhere. I haven't seen him in all these years. But our main job, and we went down to each one of the islands, and we had to lead the force. So then the force came to Alaska. Rid Alaska now. You see, Alaska was the only place in the history of the United States that was actually land taken. Sure, they bombed in Honolulu, but it was the only time in our history, over 200 years, that we've ever been invaded, and they have taken up residence. Our enemy has taken up residence in our land. So they wanted to get them out. So we went down to Dodge, to meet them, and joy the Lord. 165,000 on the troop transports. And to fool the enemy, they had trained them in the desert. And boy, we said, you really fooled us too. And I said, where's your shoe packs? What in the world is that? Well, we said, that's something that keeps your feet warm, even if they're wet. And our captain went to the general and said, look, I can spread our men out in Alaska, and I think we can go up every quick, and we can find a lot of shoe packs. What you mean? We're not going to be here for about a week. We're going back. We just come up here in front of these people off the islands, and then we're going home. So we didn't get any shoe packs. 40% casualties, frozen feet. Frozen feet. Most pathetic thing I ever saw. And we landed first at Attu, where there were only 3,600 Japanese. They were in, well, they were burrowed in those mountains, I'll tell you. Now, we didn't go first. We didn't go in with them. We went on another island near there, and then we came in later from a different direction. And was able, we were reconnoitering and sending out messages. Well, we couldn't do anything. 3 weeks later, here we are. Everybody's busy taking care of frozen feet. And this was full of snow, wind. I had an old skipper tell me that the weather of the Pacific is made in the Aleutian Islands. It's a hellhole of weather in the whole Pacific Basin, which is a huge basin. And he brought another general in. General Landrum. And as soon as he arrived, he says, Josh, where's the scouts? while they're over in Chocho. Pretty well, they build houses real fast. There are a lot of good things that float around in the ocean. We had outboard motors, we were salvaging them, radios, and, oh, we had a lot of good stuff. So he sent for our, actually, the lieutenant. We had three officers, a lieutenant, a colonel, and a general. So he sent for Bob Thompson, and he walked in the general's tent. He said, well, are you still a lieutenant? He says, oh, yes. Well, colonel, he's now captain. Now, captain, what are we going to do? Well, he said, here's what we're going to do. So I have this headquarters with this radio set, and I'll send this group out here, and then they'll split up. And in 3 days' time, we'll have every one of these Japanese pegged and know right where they're at. He said, let's do it. So we did. And going to that job, in our mind, we all thought, well, this would be it. So they turned us loose in Anchorage for 3 days. I said, go tie one on. We gave instructions to the MPs. They get down, get them up, fix them up, send them back to the bars. The guy that took on the most was Bad Whiskey Red. And he didn't have to go on that trip. He was qualified to be a skipper. So he was a seaman who had come to Alaska, got off a boat in Seward, and walked the entire railroad to Talkeetna. And then he said to an old gal up there named Bell, that had a roadhouse in Talkeetna, I wonder if you'll put me on the hook for a little supplies for the winter. She said, no way. Nice around a while. Bell was, I'd met her. She was quite a person. She could spit snooze in a little nail hole in the stove. Not even splattered. She was just a super gal. But she put me off and said, no. And he kept hanging around. And finally, he said, well, what do you need? He said, I need a pair of pliers and some wire, an axe, and some salt. And he took that out. Spent the winter in the wood. Came back with a big, all the furs he could carry. A very accomplished man. Strong hand. He didn't have to go because they had solicited him to go be a skipper on a boat. They were been manufacturing so many boats that they had to have a lot of skippers. No, he says, I will after this last trip. He says, I have been down in Evolution, so this was our ninth trip and freezing, but I want to go down there and I'm going to get me something back. But he said, when this trip is over, I'm never going to get further than 2 miles off the beach. I'm getting back on that sea where I belong. And Red got shot right between the eyes, way up on a mountain. So after we got things cleaned up a little, we put him on a shelter half, and four of us took him down and buried him right at the ocean. So Red never left the sea again. But we had a few more injured, but we were very fortunate. And went in, and they were very difficult. We couldn't capture them. We needed some prisoners, and we couldn't capture them. Boy, we did just sit around and scheme how to not shoot these people. We got 14 prisoners out of 3,600. They're tough. So we finished that, and then we went into Kiska, and we knew they had a lot there. In fact, two of us wanted to go in. We broached the plan to the colonel, and he said, well, I'd buy it, but I don't think the Navy would. We wanted to put two of us ashore in a submarine, just the two of us. And we'd go in and reconnoiter. And our scheme to get off of it was going to steal an airplane and fly this airplane. Neither one of them ever flew an airplane. We figured, you know, get the thing going and just do something. And it'd go. Not too long ago, I talked to a pilot that said, no way. Navy wouldn't let us do it anyhow. By this time we had another colonel, because we were getting right close to the Japanese, and he had been a military attaché for 6 years in Tokyo. He spoke Japanese, played Japanese songs on his harmonica. Real character, Quebec. And one day he said, there was eight of us on ADAC. And he says, gentlemen, he called everybody gentlemen, gentlemen, you must get a truck. Then go to the quartermaster and get two bales of coveralls from the quartermaster. Machete. And we'll meet on the beach. And a little excitement, you know, for doing the thing. Got the truck and coveralls. And down the beach. Gentlemen, take the machetes, cut the beach grass, nice high stuff. Fill these coveralls with straw. Make dummies. Gee, we said, that's a good idea, Colonel. We started that as a family. I said, sir, what are we doing this for? It's the Japanese. Yeah. Save face. If you trick them, boom, it's terrible. So we're going to trick them. We're going to get some parachutes from the Air Force. We're going to go down and methodically keep these dummies out in the daylight. And they'll shoot these dummies, thinking that they're people. And it'll be terrible. And we'll do this for several days. And then we'll go jump, and they won't shoot us. No way am I going to get out of an airplane with one of them little things on me. I said, unless I have to save my life. I said, this, no way, Colonel. And so we just got back to the truck and went on in. But he was a nice guy. And we landed there, and they had the people a little better equipped than this bunch. A lot of us. Oh, there was a big bunch of people, 169,000. All kinds of landing things. By this time, they were coming up with new equipment that we had never seen, like these things that climb mountains with tracks. Always before we had done the wheels. And boy, that was, we could hardly get a hold of one of them, or wait to get a hold of them so they could take it home. But, so we landed, and the Navy wouldn't let us touch anything prior to the landing. We're handling this now. And I went in with a special outfit, 1st Special Regiment, and they were super people, super trained, they were demolition. And we went ashore, towing a rubber boat loaded, heat, with high explosives. Gee, just one bullet, you know, and they would, that would have been a beautiful harbor we would have built right there. So we went ashore, and on this one beach, got up, and the scheme was they had to blow some rocks out of this particular harbor so that the landing barges could come in the morning at daybreak. So that's why we went ahead, and I had to secure the area for them, and they were doing their stuff in their rubber suits. And they got her all set, and just before daylight they blew it. And did a beautiful job, and here come the troops. Landing partners. And I don't know, to this day, what they did, the people on that, those boats, prior to launching, they had, they kind of glazed their eyes. They weren't even, they didn't even look, saying, and they would not listen to anybody. I tried to stop them. I had some guys out there, and they were going to shoot anything that wiggled. And I tried to stop them. I couldn't get them. They wouldn't listen to me. Finally, I got a captain. I said, stop, Jesus, do whatever you have to do. And he made a command, and everybody stopped. They were just ready to hit anything. And I got one in, and I was, get away from this outfit. The next, that was right at daybreak. And before dark, there was 14 crossers in that little valley. They'd shot 14 of themselves. There wasn't a single Japanese on that whole island. They'd come in there with barges, like, towing barges during very heavy weather and loaded 10,000 troops and took off, and the Navy didn't even know. I was mighty happy they were gone. So the islands were cleared that episode, and so the war was over for the illusions. We came back to Anchorage, and they wanted us to and his older son, which was not right, ultimately. So he thought up a scheme, a project, to get us out of camp. Let's go to Barrow and take some dog team. By that time, we had 300 dogs in our outfit. We had lots of dog team. And we'll map a trail from Fairbanks, or from Point Barrow to Fairbanks. And you know it's right where the Moose Pipeline. I had some people say that they had taken a map. And we built a map. Now, I didn't go. I had just recently gotten married, which broke the rules of the Army. And I said, the devil with the rules. I won't get married. No one dared get married in Alaska. No matter where your bride came from, even if it was up on the upper Yukon, she was sent to your home immediately. So I went ahead and I said, their rules. And as soon after we were married, I was real excited. I was in charge of the one that was going to go to the barrel. We had a lot of teams went out all over Alaska. Just anything to get out of Anchorage. And I was going to go on the north one, and we sent a guy up and then bought all these fur sleeping bags, and oh boy, this is going to be really something. And then one day, I think about it, what am I doing? Leaving my bride in my nice steam-heated apartment to go up there and sleep in a sleeping bag on that windswept north plain? No way. I went to the captain and I said, I'm not going. He said, I was wondering when he was going to wake up. So I didn't go, but sometimes I wondered if I shouldn't go. One of our guys got lost up there. Never, ever. That is some country. He just wandered off, lost his direction. But he had a fight with the other guy, one of the guys in charge, and he was mad. Anyhow, is there anything in particular that you'd like to ask about that period of Alaska, the military end of it? It's a thing that I haven't thought of in a long time. It was a lot of fun while we were doing it, but I sure need to do it again. It was quite an experience. And I just got a Christmas card from one of the fellows. And he is a super hunter. We were quite a long period, we were on Kamchatka, which is the Long Island, near enough to Kiska, before the invasion of Kiska. We could hear the airplane start up. And we had a radio, and we would call ADAC. And we could even tell how many planes by the roar. And we'd give them all this data, and they would send P-38s down and have their dogfight right over Amchitka. And so we would get to watch all the dogfights. And we had to be very careful. They knew we were there. And anytime we walked in a little fox trails. Very narrow, but we stayed in the fox trails, and we built Barabras, which is an underground place to live. And we had even had it so that when we'd hear the planes, we would even take our chimney in, and a straight blob of grass would go over the hole. And they just never could. They'd strap us a lot of times, but we just didn't know. They'd just doing it, you know, trying to get us to come out. But, yes.
And you know, you said that everyone in this company of yours was an individual, was absolutely an individual. And I was just wondering, do you think it's the Alaskan experience that makes the people, the characters and the individuals they are, or do you think they're pretty well this way before they, you know, come up here?
I think Alaska makes them that way. Now, here's been my experience in Alaska, more so in those days than now. We're pretty doggone modern. But I noticed that a strong person in Alaska became stronger, and a weak one became weaker. The weak ones didn't get strong, they got weaker. Now, Dan Gansky is the hunter, and I had a group of men in the middle of the island, and another group was at the end of the island. I went down there. We hadn't had anything to eat for a long time. We always, in our radio communications, did all the code. We would also include when we're stopped. Then we included our shoe packs around. And we even gave the sizes. We've been on the rocks and on the beach and outdoors. We wore holes in our shoe packs. And they wouldn't bring anything to us. They didn't want the Japanese to know where we were, so they stayed away. We acknowledged the fact that they knew we were from there. And we had a storm going. You could shoot geese, and the Empress geese winter in the oceans, especially on Chitka, which is the furthest south island. And you could shoot a goose or a seagull, but they would get into the water. Offshore wind everywhere, in every bay on both sides of the island. It was just blowing away. A terrible storm. So we hadn't had anything to eat, man. I went down to the North Island about 12 miles from the end. I bummed up a little some feet first, and then I said, hey, don't have feet. That was a terrible time. We can't get any. We can shoot the geese, but we can't. You know, they'll get in the water and off they go. Dan Gansky just got up and he says, no problem. I thought, come on, Dan. He says, sure, so I can go out right now. Before dark, I could half a dozen or whatever. Dozen? I said, not to bring home, Dan. You could shoot them maybe, but all we had was rifles. We didn't have shotguns. Oh, sure, so I can bring 12 in before dark. And I got $20 and said, you can't. By that time, we had another officer, Lieutenant Acom. He said, I'll throw 20 in that pot, too, Dan. So he was busy eating away and having his breakfast, another cup of coffee. And I said, you better get out and do some hunting. You got 40 bucks. It's going to cost you. And he said, oh, no, right. He come back an hour before dark. He had 14 geese. Dan, this $20, can you tell me how you did it? He said, sure, no problem. He said, that first one is tough. Boy, you better really work. The geese will fly over, and they'll have to come down and get in a clear stream to drink water. Can't drink salt water. They're very cautious, and they look it over real good. So Dan knew where there was a good stream, and he hid himself so well. That goose came alive, and he managed to shoot his head right off. Then he got some sticks. He propped that goose up in the crib. He said, on, it's a matter of lining him up. He only fired six shots. He had 14 geese. I said, he's just lying their heads up. He said, you get three at a time. And they're not by the ocean, so they just fall down, and then he brought them in. So he got his 40 bucks, and I got the geese and took them back to our group, and now we know how to hunt. So Dan, I just got a Christmas card from him because last summer, or the summer before, a lady came from Fairbanks who lived on for all these years. She's a writer, Mike Dalton. And she brought a daughter, and the daughter had this friend. They'd been on this trip around the world in a boat. The Sontag girl went out of that earthquake, and my niece was up here last year, and she went around. But anyhow, they had just done that. And they came down, and this one friend was a Native girl, part Native. And I don't think anyone introduced her. I didn't catch her name, you know. So, or I was probably away. But I came into the motel, and this girl said to me, are you Edgar Walker? Now, no one, hardly anyone knows my name is Edgar, because I'm known as Ed Walker. My mother was the only one that was supposed to call me that. When I was a kid, I used to have to fight the guy that was called Edgar. You know, Edgar Allan Poe had to be a sissy. He wrote poems. So, anyhow, when she said that, I knew it had to be from way back somewhere. And I said, well, now, just who are you? Well, she said, I'm Carol Dale. I said, you mean Dan lay there on the bottom. She said, that's right. He said, you go to Valley, if you look around, see if you can find a guy named Edgar Walker. And so I wrote them a card last year. Yeah, and then I got one this year. But, so there's still a few around. At one time, we reached out and we became 64 people in our group. That was when we made the Kiska landing. But normally, the basic group was 36. Yeah. Because he went, you'd see him on top of that mountain. Later, he'd be over on this mountain. He would walk 8 times further than us, and we would just barely make it to camp. Beeline. He would always be there. Fire was going, and the tea was on top. That man had walked further in this country than any half a dozen men. I mean, he's walked over the whole thing. I'd go on to a beach sometime and I'd think, the first man ever on this beach. There he is, blasted, mark of the shoe packs. He'd already been there. He kept going and he kept walking and he found it. He hit it. He found gold.
Copper strata.
Copper, and I think molybdenum was in there somewhere. Anyhow, he found it. Then Reinhardt was from Brooklyn, New York, of all places. And he didn't know what to do with it. So he went to another guy in our outfit named Jack Bullock. And let Jack in on the deal, and Jack sold it. And I think each one of them got about $2 million out of the thing. And Reinhardt hasn't changed a bit. I saw him 4 or 5 years ago in the lobby of the Anchorage Westbury Hotel. And we thought seriously and we tried to come up with a little reunion on our 25th anniversary. A few of us that are left. And I don't know, somehow we didn't get accomplished. All the officers, except one, Hickok, he's still alive, and all the rest of them.
Let me ask you something, Ed. What was the Native role in anything that occurred in the state of Alaska? Or the territory of Alaska, as it was at that time?
You mean
time?
The war?
During World War II.
Yeah, well, we had, in our outfit, we had select ones. We had Nels Hedlund from Bristol Bay. Nels was part Swede and part Indian. He was a fisherman. He was a super boatman. When we went in our boats, Nels was the captain. Our captain would say, what do you want me to do, Nels? We always relied on the person who had the expertise for whatever we were doing. We had an Aleut, which is a separate breed. Really funny people. They just don't think at all. Like this one told a story one night where we'd gone to Amchitka on a PBY. This colonel who had been a military attaché, and Joe Kelly, who had the Kelly's Photo Service in Anchorage, and the colonel and myself, we landed and had rubber boats and went ashore and were going to reconnoiter. I was securing high ground, and we had cover, we had B-24s, which is one big airplane in those days. And I was going up on this ridge to make sure that nobody was over there to shoot us. Here come that airplane. I look, and there it was, just hovering right over me. All them guns were all zeroed right on me. I knew it. And they threw something out. Something white came flooding down. So I went over, and it was they'd taken a rodent out, and they wrapped it around a pistol where the bullets were. And then put a handkerchief around it and threw it out. And the note said, submarine on North Shore. Investigate with caution. So I went in and There was an old robber there that took over. So I gave a note to the colonel. He said, all right, gentlemen, I will go capture the subject. And Walker, you go over to this spot, investigate this trapper's cabin. So as I were having a little something to eat, well, we all split up on our separate ways. And he said, oh, gentlemen, change of plans. Walker, you go get the sub, I'll go over here. Okay, boy, I grabbed my gear, I wanted to go get the sub. So I got out before he changed his mind again. And I approached it with caution. Approached it in the morning, daybreak. And I didn't know who it was, whether the people on the beach or what. But I took out two of my concussion grenades. And I pulled a pin, which I shouldn't have done. Because after I didn't need them. I had two hand grenades, no pin. So I found that it was one of our subs that had landed and had taken the men off. So I had quite a chore getting something to wrap around the thing to hold the pins, you know, hold the lever in while I threw it in the ocean. I didn't care if it went off after it got in the water, but it didn't care to make any noise. But I came back and I made quite a salvage. A pair of trousers. I tied up the pants legs and filled the pants full of cigarettes. They were in little round tins, all on the beach. I was heavy smoking those days, and I thought that was the best thing to salvage there. So I got back with a whole bunch of cigarettes, and the colonel had a handkerchief around his hand. I said, hey, what happened? Oh, boy, it's always coming. That's who? Japanese. Well, yeah, it's in the cabin over on the other beach. There, and I knew they had a radio, but I kept hearing them. I put my ear down to the tundra, and I could hear the signals. And I attacked the place, and they were out of sight. But they were up in the attic. And I got up there, and I opened the door, and I slammed the lid down and hurt my hand. Which I knew was a story. Well, some months later, I was at Dutch Harbor, and I met our Japanese interpreter that usually traveled with us. And he said, God, I thought you was in jail. I said, am I supposed to be in jail? He said, sure. Colonel Rebecca's having court-martial. I said, no kidding, for what? Why? He said, I saw the papers. He took me to headquarters in Anchorage and showed me the papers. You cut all of his prisoners' throats. You were supposed to be guarding them, and you cut all their throats, and you didn't get to bring the prisoners back. No kidding. So I didn't go back to Anchorage for a long time. I didn't dare to go up there and be court-martialed, but I don't know, I guess they knew the guy well enough to know that story, isn't it? But I still remember so much about the accomplished people that I was privileged to be with. I remember I went into a tent one night after I'd come from Anchorage and had the hiccups. But I didn't go into Red's tent for that reason. I had a bottle and I had a kid around to drink. And listened to him tell some stories. So I sat down in the bunk and he had a drink and I had a drink. He had a number 14 Neuhauser trap. And he was set. And this is the guy with the strong, fabulous hands. He could build anything. He would set that, put it down on the floor, and a little bit he would put his finger in it and get his finger out without getting caught. After a couple more drinks, I said, Fred, slip that on over here, man. I didn't talk. He would be talking while he was doing it. Boy, I was serious. Thing got me way up here. Boy, I just about cut my finger off. It was, that was a pretty strong trap. And gosh, I had to have another drink then. And I he said it, and I said, Kelly, now, I think I'm a little faster now. Well, I was. It didn't get me to the belt right here. And I had developed hiccups while this was all going on for some reason. After a while, in a flash, Red had me right by the throat. Wrong hip. Red was not as big as I am, but very strong. And I thought he'd gone off his rocker and killed him. So naturally, I fought back. We kicked the Sibley stove down. One of them didn't catch the whole place on fire. But I was serious because I knew that he was trying to kill me. And I finally broke his hold just before I was going to quit breathing. And boy, did I hang on to him. I said, now, Red, be quiet. Be all right. You want another drink? Well, so you want one? That's who you got. And we had a drink. He says, no more hiccups. He scared him the hell out of me. I know he did. Boy, I thought I was a dead one, but he just scared me so bad, no more hiccups. We had other Eskimos. We had some from Wainwright, way up between Kotzebue and Barrow. His name was Hugh Fixon. We break it, we fix it. And he was yellow. He was an Eskimo, yellow. And then he got yellow jaundice on top of that one time, out in the woods. We were out in the woods on the far end of Mount McKinley, four of us, built a naked sled. Walked out there and spent the winter out in the woods. Pretty comfortable. We had the ranger's cabin. We were eating sheep, which is the best meat in the woods. And that was exceptionally good because it was in the park. Out of season. No license. In a ranger's cabin. That was very good eating. But he got the yellow jaundice there, and that was a darnest reason. If you were anywhere near the Japanese right now, you'd get shot. He looked so much like a Japanese, added color of yellow jaundice. But we didn't lose him. We brought him in. We went to the park and sent him back down to the Anchorage hospital. But we had one that was part Russian. His name was Delketty. And Delketty was a pretty good boatman, but he wasn't very smart. At ADAC, we had a halibut set. And I loved halibut fresh. So I said to Nels one day, the smart fisherman, I said, so, Nels, let's go out and check the set and see if we got some halibut. I thought, come on, a few clouds to stop us about 2 miles up the bay. And I said, so I went to the dump.
Sure.
This dory called Hup 1. We had Hup 1, Hup 2, and Hup 3. Never did figure out how you would call it Hup. But that's why we had painted on the side, you know. So we went out and got to the set. We gassed up. We had a man horse coming. And we gassed up, and that usually would take you in. And it was getting a lot of sea. And boy, that storm hit. Get any house to do it. And we started in, and finally we had the gas up, and we didn't dare shut it down. We had the gas up on the run. Then we lost the gas cap, put a handkerchief. Water was coming up over that motor. That sea was, and I was up in the bow, and I was right there, and I didn't know it, and he should have known that I should have brought that boat down, it would leap right out of the water. It was the wave above from underneath.
30-40
and I would bring it down flat. I thought I was really doing something good. Mm-hmm. It's a wonder I didn't split it wide open, they told me later. And, finally, the Navy had their glasses on us, and they up anchor on a cruiser. It was a big boat. We were going to come and get us, and we got in a little bit of lee, and we were just making it. And they lined the cruiser, all the sailors. They all give us a big signal. well done, sailors, and they didn't know what kind of people they were encountering. I had also, on that submarine expedition, I had gotten an Annapolis officer sweater. Beautiful wool sweater. And I wore it. But I also adapted the sailor's little round white hat, because you can pull it down and over your ears. And I had army clothes, army pants, and an officer sweater. So they didn't know whether to thumb their nose or salute me or what, but they gave us a big cheer, and we went by there, and that laughed a little. I asked Joe Kenny, I said, "What? Didn't you know the storm was coming?" "You can't tell." I said, "Well, Nels sure can. He knew it was coming, and he wouldn't go in there." But they're all good. They're all good men. And we're quite a thing. So, any more questions?
Are you aware of any military buildup or, say, fortifications that went on in the Prince William Sound area during the Second World War?
There wasn't any. See, this used to be one of the earlier forts over at Dayville. That was an army installation. Yes.
Did you have anything to do with the road that was being built through from Canada up through around Salina and in that area?
Yeah, my involvement with that was that I married one of the 13 girls that came from Washington, D.C. in an airplane in the middle of the winter to build that road. And she was in on the beginning and she was there at the end. And she was a dispatcher of transportation, my wife. And she was one of 13 women that came for that purpose.
I have been on that. My husband, when he was left, did a lot of hunting and trapping in that area. Mm-hmm. And you'll find bridges out where there's no roads. And,
oh, yeah.
And people wouldn't believe it unless they actually were there. And you tell them about it now, and they think you have a screw loose or two.
Well, you see, they were just, boy, that to build that road through Canada was quite an endeavor, really. I just marvel at it. I've been over it 3 or 4 times. And they did it without any knowledge. The only one that they had was a guy named McDonald, who was from Fairbanks, and he is the one that went to Washington and convinced the president that that's what they ought to do, build a road. Because, you see, Billy Mitchell had, he was a young man who came to Alaska as a second lieutenant. When the Flyers weren't in an Air Force, they were in the Signal Corps. And he came to Alaska as a young man, to Valdez, with a string of mules that he loaded with books. And he went north and wintered at Delta, Big Delta, not Delta Junction, Big Delta, right at the river on a bluff. And he studied navigation and phenomena of the airplane. And then it was later that he tried to convince the admirals and the generals, and he was court-martialed for being a nut. And what he said was true. And this McDonald had met this man when he was on that creek. And he remembered all of that. And he went to Washington and convinced the brass that Billy Mitchell was right and who holds Alaska holds the world. Because you see, most of us are crowded in the northern hemisphere. And that is a strategic spot, as it's proven today. Everybody flies over the top of it. And that's why he was able to convince the president and the group that they had to build a road to be able to supply. If we lost the supremacy of the ocean, we had to get supplies into whole Alaska, because if somebody else got it, we would be finished. That would be their stepping stone on into Kansas and they helped. So that's why we have that road. It was a fabulous. It held the record for a long time until they built that pipeline. as an engineering feat, and it was an engineering feat. There are no few bridges that get used, but the guy who built the bridges didn't know where the guy's going to put the road either.
That's right. And why were the Aleutian Islands so strategic to the Japanese?
No, they weren't strategic to them in that first instance. All they were trying to do was get them to bring the whole Pacific fleet over here, because they landed here before they were going to do their thing down in the South Pacific. Mm-hmm. And they tried to make out like they were going to do something, but it was going to be their stepping stone.
Sure.
Then the last job I had with that group was I became a balloon chaser. I don't know what my qualifications were, but I was selected to go with a guy from Washington, FBI agent in Anchorage, and I got on a plane and off we went. Went down to Alaska Peninsula and turned in went to Bethel. And what had happened, the Eskimos had sent word out that all of their lakes were poisoned from Japanese putting things in their lakes. And one lake usually relates to the next lake and the next lake. So we went in and got to Bethel, and we had to ask questions. And Indians are odd, you have to understand them in a lot of ways. They're somewhat like children. But you have to understand them, or you don't get anything done. Anyhow, the first day, this FBI slipped out my badge. Boy, imagine what that did to a native. He wouldn't tell you his name. Anything. So that night, we're sitting in the bunkhouse and the roadhouse. He said, "Well, we're going to accomplish much today." I said, "Yes, we'll accomplish exactly the same thing tomorrow, unless you leave that damn thing in your pocket." Quit flipping that badge on. No. Might be for you. I'll ask the questions. I don't have a badge. You just follow on. We went down or upriver to a slough and went up the slough. I'd heard that there was a little storm. And I was hoping that they hadn't heard about us yet. And I went in and just ignoring nobody in the storm. So I looked around and something that I could make conversation with. They had a lot of chicken wire, rolls of chicken wire. So I hollered out, "Is anybody home?" And boys from the back, the store, in the kitchen. Said, "Yeah, just a minute. Coffee isn't ready yet." So he came out there with the coffee pot. And he says, "Look at us. What do you want?" "Chicken wire over there. How much are you getting for a roll of that?" "Which one?" I said, "The 1 inch." What do you want it for?" "Well, take it back to Anchorage." "What are you going to do with it to Anchorage?" "Mm-hmm. Oh, we'll build some crab pots." "Oh, all right. Want a cup of coffee?" We were in. I had a little conversation. A week later, got around the subject of who do we see, who can lead us to these balloons of the lakes. So he told me a lady to go see. "Now you tell her I told you that. Come see her. And then she'll tell you. And she'll get the word." So she did. And we went out. I hired an interpreter. And we went out and found a balloon. Balloon was 40 foot in diameter, made of paper. Underneath the balloon was a little framework, light metal. And lashed onto it was a series of incendiary bombs. And they had little bags of sand on them too. It was so arranged that you see there's stratas of air coming from the Far East to the U.S. Their scheme was to get it up, and they had instruments on there to get it into a certain altitude, and it hit that airstream, and it all go. The scheme was they were going to burn the woods of the United States, Oregon, California, Washington. These incendiary bombs would land and ignite all of them, and they would lose the war. That was their scheme. And they got in the wrong strata, and they all came into the Cuscatlan River Valley, in Oregon, Alaska. Three known about the Oregon. So we had to bring it in. And it was quite a thing. We had to fly out and get it. And he she asked him if he was a, what's he going to do with the bombs? Well, he said, we'll take everything in. I said, yeah, but you got to make them so they don't go off. And he said, well, I don't know anything about that. So the airplane guy had a pair of pliers, and I found the fuse. It was just a fuse like you use for dynamite, actually. And I follow that fuse up and then clip it. It blew off. So then I did that for all the bombs, and I took all the fuses, and they had little caps. And we brought it in, and it was so secret. I never did figure out why it was so secret. They run the airplane. They didn't let us out of the airplane, an army plane. It runs right in the hangar. And then we took the bomb out, and all the paper, and they dried it off, and dispatched the FBI agent and the balloon to Washington. And so then I became number one balloon chaser. And I spent the rest of the winter chasing balloons. At quite a time, even out on St. Lawrence Island, there was two out there. And I had to go out there and retrieve them. Finally, I quit bringing in the balloons. They were just so, a lot of them were in the ice and the creeks. And so I just wrote in the report that it was destroyed. You hear about the Eskimos, it was during the season of trapping of muskrats. And the country was swarming with Eskimos. And we landed, the marshal wanted to go with me on this particular trip, so we went in. And the lake, it was getting pretty close to spring, and the lake started cracking. I just got out of the plane, and I said, boy, here was a crack. I said, ow! Get going. So he took off and went and found a better lake and landed, and I walked on over in this. But this time, all of the trappers were in evidence, and I was up the tree. It was a spruce tree, and it was tangled up in there, and I was up there with my pliers cutting these things. And the marshal hollered up and says, if you cut the wrong one of them, the bombs explode. Circle, and boy, those Eskimos run and just scattered. So they go on. It's like the time I bought a tusk, a walrus tusk. I stumbled over it in one of the houses on St. Lawrence. And I wanted it. It was nice. But it's coming up from the skull. So I asked the lead guy, the white man there, the school teacher, what I did about that. Did I buy that? And sure, you have to negotiate. Would you need a contributor? I did. I got some turner, and we negotiated for 3 days. Now we wore out with this, and then all of the men would go with all of our little treats. We wound up in the store because we decided it would be by the pound. But I said, I'm not going to pay 50 cents a pound for the bone that the ivory is attached to. So now we've got to determine how much of this weight is bone and how much is ivory. Oh, here we are in the store. The store was cold. They didn't have anything in there for 3 weeks. They didn't have any heat. So just beans and things like that. We had to scale. So we made it. Then they had to pass it all around to everybody. And they were all jabbering. I was real weary of this. Came back to me. The guy told me, I said, give me 20 bucks. He said, I'll take it. You can stand there all 3 days. But that was the custom, you know, so you didn't
want to be the custom. Actually, a lot of people that bargain like to bargain.
Oh, yeah.
And it's pretty hard, you know, to break that habit.
Yeah. The in the Orient they do it, right? You went over to the Orient, didn't you?
No.
They do it in Turkey, Greece.
Yeah, and we're going to have to dismiss the class because the janitors want us out here up here by 10. But on behalf of the class, I'd just like to thank you for your fascinating presentation. We'd love for you to come back.
I think it'd be good if you were able to speak. I was able to go to the Alaska Historical Meeting, and it was in Haines, and Mrs. Clifton was telling me about you had, worked, I don't know if worked is the right word, but had been stationed at the barracks up there at Chilkoot.
Sitka. And Chilkoot barracks both.
In Haines and Sitka also?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't
know.
Yeah,
I was only in Sitka 3 months, but I was there. We were the first soldiers to arrive. I was a Navy town.
How about Haines?
Haynes, I was there a year.
Yeah. She was saying that it would be good to get your experiences about that.
Yeah, I'm going to South Africa next week. When I come back, I have an audience debate on the great last movie. Two of them, actually, in South Africa.
Oh.
And they...